This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dahlia Lithwick joins us live in studio. She's a senior editor at Slate.com, a columnist for Newsweek, and the legal commentator for NPR's Day to Day program. And it is a true honor to welcome her back to the studio. You know, I was saying this earlier. I think you're arguably the smartest woman that's ever been in this room. I'm totally serious. And I always look forward to you coming because it's like, oh, now I can understand things. Oh, good. I'm so glad you're here.
No pressure there, Coy.
No, well, you know what? You're somebody that literally gets in her car and will drive to the Supreme Court of the United States and sit and listen for hours and really sort of understands what's going on. And I really admire that. Because I don't think many people in this country could do that.
I'm not entirely clear that all the justices know what's going on in there. I'm certainly have no idea what's going on, but I'll take the compliment nevertheless.
Good deal.
Okay.
Good deal. So let's start, though, before we get to SCOTUS, let's start with the election, the elections, plural, and what happened a couple of weeks ago. Just where were you that night watching the returns at home?
No, I was doing live TV. I did, Dan Rather has this great HD TV show, so I was on the show, and the makeup lady, because it's HD TV, they put on like, they just lacquer on the makeup, you know, because like every pore is the size of Cleveland. So I had perhaps 8 or 9 layers of mascara on my eyes. And when I started tearing up, when they announced, the makeup lady was about a foot away from me, just going, don't, like just thinking like there were going to be like Tammy Faye black raccoons, yeah. Which there were. So I guess in case you wondered whether I was happy about the Obama decision, I was quite happy.
I've said this before. You could be a far right wing conservative thinking the guy was Muslim and had a crazy Christian pastor. And still, I would find it hard for even that person not to have been moved by the history that was made that night.
I think that's right. And what one of the most touching things was McCain's concession speech, which was, you know, for those of us who used to really like McCain before this campaign started, it was like seeing the old McCain back.
Yeah, it was more of the McCain of 2000, like, oh, there he is.
Right. Just, you know, my husband described it as him sort of taking off the Darth Vader mask. Like, who was that guy? And suddenly it was just this genuine, heartfelt, you know, recognition that this was an historic moment and that the better man had won and that the country had to rally behind Obama. And, you know, he would say gracious things and the audience would boo.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then he'd look sort of startled, like, where are you getting
they
all this hatefulness
from? Quite ready.
They
weren't quite ready to make that move yet, were they?
Well, you know, where did that come from? I mean, I think if you stir people up with xenophobia and with, you know, paranoid ideas of outsiders and non-Americans, then expecting them to turn on a dime just because you know you were just talking doesn't really happen. I mean, they drank the Kool-Aid. So, but it was really, I thought, very touching to see McCain back that night.
Yeah. There were those, that moment and then the moment where they both did the comedy at the New York dinner were some two of my favorite moments from the campaigns. The night of the election night speeches. And then that moment when they both did their comedy, their stand-up routine, those were the two nights I think I enjoyed the most, because I think that's when we really saw the as close as possible to the real human beings.
It's interesting. It occurred to me only yesterday, you know, a week and a half later, that probably my favorite moment from this campaign was actually Colin Powell's statement that the right answer to the question, he's not a Christian. The right answer is, even if he weren't, why would it matter? And that incredibly moving speech he gave about the soldier that was buried who was a Muslim and his mother hunched over the grave. And just, I think that in terms of a brave moment for him to step forward, Obama should have done it and said, you know, little Muslim children in this country should also grow up thinking that they can get to be president. And I just think that might be one of the most under-recognized but very poignant moments of this whole campaign for me.
Right, because for folks who might not remember, McCain took the microphone away from the woman who said he was a Muslim and said, no, he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good guy. He's an honorable man. He's a good father. We just disagree on policy, but he's still a good guy. He's, as you know,
It was a triple slam. It was just so loaded with, I don't think intentionally, but with sort of slams at Obama. And really, I think for Powell to come out and say the thing that no one had been brave enough to say, which is, this is not a country in which being a Muslim makes you not a candidate for president. And that's not something necessarily people want to hear after 9/11. But I think it needed to be said. And I think the fact that it came from Powell and not really from Obama or his surrogates was very telling about where we are at this moment, how deeply fearful we are of Muslims.
Yeah. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, NPR, and Newsweek. A very nice segue then to the election that was closest to home, and that was here in the 5th District, incumbent Republican Virgil Goode, a man who has said publicly, we need to stop Muslims from getting into elected office in America and figure out a way to prevent them from getting into Congress.
Right.
A very different viewpoint from that expressed by Colin Powell.
Even more freighted than that, I think what he said was, on top of keeping them out of office, that if we adopted his immigration policies, we wouldn't have them overrunning the country. So it wasn't just the sort of at the most elite levels of government we need to keep them out. We need to keep them out of, you know, from being voters. And that was, I think, even
from even living here,
more
yeah.
toxic. Yeah, you know, I covered the race a little bit. Just at the very end, Coy, I was asked to do a piece for Slate about why Virginia suddenly was the most hot button, exciting state. You know, I never saw a political commercial in my life for a presidential. Like, what's going on?
I didn't even know it was swingable, and all of a sudden, it's swinging like crazy.
It was swinging, and everybody was looking at us. And in fact, there was a funny moment where I called Larry Sabato and said, "I'm reporting out this story about why is Virginia in play?" And he just groaned audibly. He was like, "Oh, this story," because every national newspaper in the country had written that story, and you know, nobody thought that way about Virginia. So it's very, very interesting. And one of the things that I learned from talking to Sabato and Bob Gibson and a lot of other people who are very savvy Virginia watchers is that it's a colossal mistake to think of this as a sort of Northern Virginia trend. You know, these are Easterners who overran, you know, Fairfax, and they're imposing their vision on the South. That in fact, it's much more complicated than that. That, as we know now from the Perriello race, Danville, Southside, those places were very much in play. And that it's not a simple North-South, red-blue, rich-poor, rural-urban, all of those shortcuts that we like to use describing Virginia are in fact not true. And I think to hear Sabato, Gibson, and others tell it hasn't actually been true for years.
Interesting. So what is true then? What if it's not as simple as that? And I the first thing I think of is I remember Nancy Fotenhauer, a surrogate for the McCain campaign, talking about the real Virginia. And she said, you know, Northern Virginia is not real because it's just all those D.C. Democrats who've moved into Northern Virginia and sort of taken over. So you have to sort of write that off. That's not really Virginia anymore.
Right. And John McCain's brother, I think a week later, called that part of Virginia Communist Virginia. Nice. So definitely, I think that's a shorthand that people like to use, that essentially those D.C. suburbs are New Jersey. You know, they're just the Northeast. And they've grafted themselves onto this deeply Southern conservative state. But again, talking to people, that's simply not the truth. What needed to happen is what both the Obama campaign and the Perriello campaign did, which is go into those towns that had been ceded for so long and say, here I am, I'm shaking hands. You know, in Southside, in Danville, they were setting up offices. They were going out and meeting people, you know, hauling them off their tractors and saying, here's why you shouldn't be afraid to vote Democrat. You know, that the Obama offices in Harrisonburg, Obama office. I mean, even here in town, you know, they had two offices. They were out there working the streets. They were so well organized. One of the other things that was interesting about reporting out this story was hearing from the Obama campaign how they sent some of their best people to Virginia after the Iowa caucuses. They really wanted to win this state, and they worked so hard to get it.
And a lot of those Southerners in Virginia who you know, once upon a time they voted Democrat, or they're people whose dad and granddaddy all voted Democrat once upon a time. That's how you voted in Virginia.
Right. And it's almost a demographic that's aging out, you know, that who switched to be Republicans over civil rights, who are now sort of aging out in some ways, either coming around to the view that, hey, wait, I'm not, in fact, a rich New Yorker who makes $250,000 a year, or alternatively realizing that this is not enough to keep voting Republican. And, you know, one of the other things that's so interesting is the Virgil Goode style of very, very morality-based, very insider-outsider, quite xenophobic, was a mode that we saw on a larger scale played out with Sarah Palin, right? The notion that this is a Christian country, that there are good people and bad people, patriots and not, that anyone with dark skin is suspect. It was a microcosm of that same race, and I think both races, the presidential race and that 5th district race, really sort of revealed that this country may have transcended that kind of very narrow, insular politics of me versus everybody who doesn't look like me.
Yeah, it's a great statement when here, even in the 5th district in Virginia, when that kind of campaigning, it didn't work. I mean, it still worked with a lot of people, but it didn't win the election.
And think about the fact that everybody said 4 years ago, Kerry lost because he didn't talk back about the Swift voting. He didn't answer.
Sat on his
the
hands,
ugliness.
Yeah.
And yet both Perriello and Obama, I think, went out of their way. Look, they made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Went out of their way to try to take the high road on these things. And, you know, Tom Perriello, when I interviewed him, said, we just wouldn't go there. When he came after us with this darkened photo and claims that he was a New York carpetbagger, Perriello just wouldn't touch it, other than with this very quirky, humorous ad about being a New Yorker.
So yeah, yeah.
I think there's really also a lesson to be learned, and you don't have to go to the bottom of the barrel and be as vile and xenophobic and racist as we thought we did, that elections don't have to be fought dirty. And I think the Obama campaign taught us a lot about being controlled and being adult and being non-drama queens and non-hysterical. And every step of the way, when people were writing those crazy, Obama needs to get mad, Obama needs to get mad op-eds, he just resisted it. And he just showed us what a grown-up looks like.
Yeah. It's really something. And not only did that negative stuff not work, it backfired. And what was so exciting for me was that so many of Americans seemed to stand up and say, you know what, I'm so sick of that. That doesn't resonate with me anymore. I'm just so sick of that really dirty, negative politics. We got problems. Let's talk about the problems and let's figure out a way to solve them. I thought one of the most refreshing things I heard this year was from Tom when he sat here at this table and he said, you know, it's not about right or left anymore. We have a new generation who doesn't give a damn about that. My words, not his. He said, we got a problem. Ideas will come from both sides. Let's all go to the table, put the ideas on the table, and figure out how to fix the problem. And who cares if you're right or left anymore? Let's just talk about ideas to fix the problems.
And really, that's what his campaign did. They collapsed the idea between religion and secular in Americans. They collapsed the difference between red and blue states. They collapsed a lot of the very, very shorthand, simple notions of what safety and security means. Just all of those ideas, those artificial boundaries. And then you turn around and you look and you say, hey, it's true. There are religious people who are liberal. You know, hey, it's true. There are people who are very concerned about security who are liberal. It's just not as simple as these caricatured views of campaigns that for years have been putting out. So I think that's true. I think we're not just post-race. We're sort of post-dopey. You know, we're post-making very, very simple shorthand caricatured distinctions that allow us to say, oh, you're you and we're and we can't talk to each other. I think we've realized we have more in common than we think, particularly when the economy's down the toilet.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, NPR, and Newsweek. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for a local news update. When we get back, we'll turn our attention to the Supreme Court of the United States. We'll get the very latest, and I think you have a little Supreme Court gossip to share as well. Looking forward to that. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate.com, a columnist with Newsweek magazine, and the legal commentator for NPR's day-to-day program. She joins us live in studio. So, let's talk about the Supreme Court. And can we start first with the nuts and the bolts? Because just for the casual observer, that's really the most confusing part about government. How many people are up there? How many people work there? It's a huge building. How many people work in there? And how does it work? You know, that we're seeing cases in the news. They're talking about this. You know, they're arguing this. Still confusing to me. I just, it's sort of a mystery.
That's kind of by design. I mean, the first thing you need to know is it's the most secretive branch of the government. They don't give press conferences, right? Sometimes when I'm guest lecturing classes, I like to smoke out the big liars by saying, how many of you watch the court's oral arguments on C-SPAN? And they all put up their hands. And I'm like, you big liars, they don't cover it. So that's just a little.
They're not on C-SPAN.
They're not on anywhere. You
get some audio, though, once in a while.
Well,
right?
That's one of the big crack-ups about the court is that since Bush v. Gore in 2000, then Chief Justice William Rehnquist said, we should let people listen to us hearing argument. This is kind of important. And so he allowed for audio to be released that day. The hour after the argument was finished, you could hear it on NPR. You could listen to it on C-SPAN. But instead of saying, hey, that worked really well, America listened in, you know, the sky didn't fall, nobody's assaulting us at the Safeway over the cabbages, maybe we could really do this, the court has continued this preposterous policy of only allowing it two or three times a year. And so, for instance, some of the cases that were heard last week and 2 weeks ago that were really interesting cases where the court had requests from C-SPAN to please do same-day audio, the court declined to do so. And I've written, and I don't think it's made anyone at the court very happy, that the worst thing you want to do at the Supreme Court is only provide audio on abortion cases, on affirmative action cases, on the hot-button cases that they allow audio. All that does is give America a very, very skewed notion that this is a 5-4 court and all they do is vote their ideology. So I think, I've always said, if the court wants people to be familiar and comfortable with the court and not have this very deep unease about this unelected, unaccountable branch that's appointed for life, make them listen to some good maritime law cases, right. You know, some takings cases, some really deathly boring Commerce Clause cases. And then they would know that 90% of what the court does is not hot button political, you know, moral issues. It's just the nuts and bolts of interpreting the law. So that's a big.
Are you in favor of cameras there? Would you support C-SPAN setting up shop in the court?
I am. I mean, I think there's no credible reason for not having them. The courts that have experimented with it have all said it's been fine. The court's afraid of the Lance Ito problem, you know, where it becomes endless months of crazy circus. But that was really a testament to Lance Ito's inability to control his courtroom. I don't think there's a single.
The O.J. trial, of
the
course.
The O.J. trial, yeah. Right. I don't think there's a single reason that I've ever heard for not having cameras in there, except that it's the justices who make that call. So as long as the justices make that call, Justice David Souter, the reclusive liberal from New Hampshire, has famously said they will roll cameras into that court over my cold, dead body. So they're not going to let it happen. And I think that, you know, that's unfortunate because this is a branch of government that is the most mysterious. People are appointed for life. They are completely unaccountable. And then to add to that this layer of you don't know when we're sitting, you don't know what we're arguing, you don't know what we're deciding, I think mystifies it unnecessarily. It makes Americans very uneasy. So that's not an answer to your question. The answer to your question is the court hears argument from October through April. They tend to decide the big, big blockbuster cases in June, but they're handing down decisions all year long. Last week, they decided a big sonar case that allows the Navy to continue to use sonar in their training exercises, even though it arguably is killing whales. But they're handing down cases at all times. One of the other things that's very interesting about the court is that they're hearing far fewer cases than they've heard in decades. I mean, every year for the last 7, 8, 9 years, the court has reduced its caseload. It used to hear 120. Now, last year, I think it heard 78 on the merits. So it's hearing fewer and fewer. And that means that the decisions at the lower courts, the federal courts of appeals, are the law of the land in the vast majority of cases. Now, those courts don't get a lot of our attention. But really, for all intents and purposes, that's where the action is.
How many people work in that building, you think?
Well, hundreds. I mean, each of the justices.
Hundreds. Wow.
Yeah, no, it's a massive building. Each of the justices has three or four clerks. They have secretaries. There's an enormous support staff. There's an entire press office. There's marshals. There's bailiffs. So, and you're right, it's an enormous building that occupies an entire block. But I think that it's really unfortunate because I really believe the court is the one branch of government that Americans do revere and do hold in some esteem. But I don't know that they should have to fear it as something unknowable and incomprehensible. I think if they saw the justices doing their work, if they could hear oral argument or see it, they'd be a lot more comfortable. I will give you this caveat, which is former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor used to always say in response to arguments like I'm making, that's a bunch of bunk. We're the most transparent branch of government because all of our work is in our published opinions. We show our work. So, you know, there is an argument on the other side that there's nothing that's happening in secret because they write their opinions, they write their dissent, they let you know which cases they're taking, they let you know which ones they're not, they let you know their reasoning. So her feeling always is, it's not that we're mysterious or secret, it's right there in front of you. And wouldn't it be nice if Congress operated that way? So that's the argument on the other side.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, NPR, and Newsweek, and you have some gossip from the court. What's the word from chambers?
Well, whenever there's an election, everybody just goes into this feeding frenzy of who's going to retire and whose names are being floated and who's on the shortlist and who's on the long list and who's making the shortlist. And we all get kind of crazy. But there's been so a week ago, I would have told you, and I said this throughout the campaign season, the word on the street was no matter who was elected president, there were going to be between one and three retirements in the next 4 years. Why? Because the justices are very old. Justice Stevens, John Paul Stevens, is 88. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 75. She's a cancer survivor. Justice Kennedy is 75. I mean, this is not a youthful crew by any means.
And the liberals are the old ones, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing, was that throughout the talk of the election, what people, I don't know if they always understood, was that the people who are going to leave are going to be the moderate to liberal justices. In other words, Stevens, Ginsburg, and the other person that was rumored to really be wanting off the court, it was 69-year-old, not very old, but very disaffected David Souter, who just hates Washington, hates it. And
he's been there for a long time.
Well, he's never liked it. He's a funny character. He doesn't give a lot of speeches. He's from New Hampshire. He lives on this kind of rinky-dink farmhouse. He doesn't have a television. He has said famously all he wants to do, as I said, he doesn't want cameras in there for sure, but all he really wants to do is go back to New Hampshire and pour himself a glass of sherry and read books. You know, he never really wanted to be on the court, and he's miserable there. And my friend Jan Crawford Greenberg at ABC did a funny blog post last week where she said he just wants to kind of cover himself in scratchy blankets up there and read. But it's really true. He just does not like the court. He dislikes it so much that he leaves the day the session ends. He literally is a foot out the door as the session ends, and often misses the big concluding dinner with his colleagues. He simply hates it. So there's a lot of rumor, a lot of scuttlebutt that even though he's only 69, he wants to be off the court. But a lot of good reporting has been done this week by people who have good sources, both in the Obama administration and at the court. And there's a little bit of pushback now where Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's, as I said, 75, gave a very funny speech last week at Columbia where she said she's shooting for Justice Stevens' record and she wants to be 88 when she's off the court. So she's got a way to go. Stevens has said that to anybody who asks that he is going to keep on working as long as he can write. As long as he can write his opinions, he's going to stay there.
The 88-year-old. Yep.
Yeah. And even Justice Souter, we're now hearing that he kind of wants the word out there that he's not going anywhere. And so all of our overheated guesses and thoughts about who's going to be next and is it going to be two vacancies or four vacancies and who's going to fill them might be premature because it's entirely possible. They're telegraphing in the way they do, which is very subtly, that they're none of them, including the older ones, have any plans to go anywhere anytime soon. And we may be in for, you know, years and years of the same Supreme Court.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, NPR, and Newsweek. So who would, even if we had Stephen step down, Who would who's on the short list? Who would Obama pick? Really liberal judges or moderate judges, do you think?
Well, that's its own really interesting conversation that's going on now, Coy, where a lot of liberal think tanks and advocacy groups are saying, look, what's missing at the court is a sort of intellectual power center on the left, an answer to Scalia, an answer to John Roberts, an answer to both Clarence Thomas and Alito, who are really forceful conservatives, very ideological, very sharp, whatever you think of their politics, they are a force. And the progressives on the court are much more pragmatic. They're much more middle of the road. When Clinton appointed Ginsburg and Breyer, he went out of his way to put on judges who are very moderate. They are not analogs to Scalia. And so Obama's getting a tremendous amount of pressure from left-wing groups to put somebody who's an intellectual counterpart to Scalia on the court, you know, somebody who is as far to the left as Scalia is to the right. But I think it's probably fair to say that's not going to happen. Obama's really a constitutional law professor. His advisors tend to be middle-left, moderate pragmatists. Most of his advisors, his legal advisors, are people like Cass Sunstein at Harvard Law School. These are not bomb throwers. And so it's just going to be a very interesting thing to see how this plays out. My guess is he's going to do much closer to what Bill Clinton did, which is put women, minorities. He's probably going to want to put the first Hispanic on the court. He's going to care a lot about a court that looks like America. I don't think he wants a court that answers tit for tat far right wing ideologues with far left wing ideologues. I think he knows that would be bad for the court and bad for the country. I may be wrong, but I think we're going to see the court continue to drift somewhat to the right, because if you don't answer the far right with far left, you're going to see what we've seen in the last couple of years, which is even the liberals on the court are not even as close to the liberals that we saw in Warren, Brennan, Thurgood Marshall. These are moderate liberals. So the court is moving, slowly moving. Even the left of it is moving to the center and to the right.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. You can read her work online at slate.com, in newspapers across the country, and, of course, Newsweek magazine. Let's talk about one of these cases that the court has heard recently. Is it Summum? Is that how I say it?
It's pronounced Summum, as far as I understand it. This was a very...
I have to say, I was laughing out loud reading your work on the computer, and I emailed you saying it was great. It's a great piece, and that's one of your strengths, is you take these sort of complicated legal issues that can get confusing, and you just lay them out so succinctly with a lot of humor in there. And I really enjoyed reading that.
Well, thank you. This one was a little dada, even for me, I have to say. This the court's religion jurisprudence is its own form of insanity, Coy. I mean, this is not good, smart constitutional legal thinking. And the best example I can give you, this is kind of disaggregated from the Summum case, but you know, the court's basic policy that people are going to have to start thinking about as Christmas approaches, and are creches constitutional or unconstitutional?
Creches meaning
those displays of a baby Jesus in a manger that the city's put on city property,
right.
And there's been a bajillion lawsuits over the constitutionality of that. And in essence, what the courts have said, what the Supreme Court has said about those creche cases, is as long as you throw a teddy bear in there and a Rudolph and make it look kind of secular, it's okay. I mean, the test is bananas. And so, you know, you got city attorneys all over the country who are looking at these baby Jesuses in the manger, and they're like, is it too Christian? Is it going to upset, you know, a reasonable observer who isn't deeply Christian? And so the answer is throw in a Teddy Ruxpin, and, you know, it's all okay. I mean, it's crazy. And so this Summum case that the court heard last Wednesday was another example of these just wacky religion cases. And this case touched on a lot of things, and that's what made it hard, but it touched on these Ten Commandments displays. Because just as cities have had to face challenges to their Christmas displays, a lot of cities across the country face challenges when they have these enormous monuments to the Ten Commandments, which are arguably not secular. And you get into this weird situation where cities are arguing, oh no, we love these Ten Commandments, but not because they're religious, because they're secular, which is preposterous, right? They like them because they're religious. They just can't say that. So this was a really strange set of facts where a religion called Summum goes to this city in Utah and says, we want to put, if you have a Ten Commandments display, we want to put up our Summum monument to the seven aphorisms of Summum. Now, Summum believes in not to make fun of them, but they believe that, I think, blue, bald aliens brought the laws of Summum down to the planet, and one of their seven aphorisms is everything vibrates. It's a little weird. Anyway, the city in question said, no, we're not going to take your wacky monument because we have the Ten Commandments. And in doing so, they sort of embraced this religious symbol of the Ten Commandments. So the case turned into this very, very strange, is it an act of speech deprivation when a city says we will put up the Ten Commandments, but we won't put up the seven monument, the seven aphorisms of Summum? Is that somehow disparaging or refusing to accept a certain form of speech? It was partly a speech case, but it was really all braided in with these weird Ten Commandments cases because the city was arguing, in effect, we love these Ten Commandments, but we love them because they're secular. So it was just
because it's so historical,
right?
It's not really because it's a religious thing,
right? And yeah. And you know, to the extent that I can distill anything useful out of this, it's that a couple years back, the Supreme Court heard a pair of cases about Ten Commandments on the same day. And these were two displays that were virtually identical. All of these Ten Commandment monuments that dot the country in this country went up because when the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston came out, Cecil B. DeMille worked together with the Eagles to get these monuments put everywhere to promote the movie. So it's, I guess it is secular in some sense. But the court, when it heard a pair of cases about monuments that looked almost identical, found that on the same day, one was constitutional and the other one wasn't. So where the state of the law is on this, anybody's guess. But the Summum case was yet another layer of insanity.
How do you think it'll come down?
Well, I think that they're going to have to find a very narrow, very fact-specific
they're very good at that,
way
aren't they?
Yeah. To decide this. I think they're going to say when the government appropriates a monument and it becomes government speech, the government can say what it wants, even if it means disfavoring other kinds of speech. They're going to do it as a government speech case, and then they're going to say, free speech does not extend to you have a monument, I get to march up with my monument and demand a right to be alongside you. I think that's where it's going to go.
So it won't be about endorsing a particular religion. They'll make it a free speech thing.
They'll make it not just a free speech, but this very, very obscure area of free speech that has to do with government speech, basically saying the government, when it speaks, is allowed to have preferences and not. The government does that every day. Otherwise, the government couldn't speak at all. This is the government speaking as the government, and the government speaking as the government wants you to know that, golly, it likes the Ten Commandments, even though they're not religious.
And the poor Summumites, what will they do?
They are very sad. Their founder, whose name is Corky Ra Summum, died just as this case was being accepted at the Supreme Court. But luckily, again, I'm not making fun exactly, they do believe in mummification. So hopefully he will, from wherever he is, live to, not live, I guess, but
mummify.
It's a very strange case.
Dahlia Lithwick, read her work now online at Slate.com in Newsweek magazine. And you can hear her on NPR, and she joins us occasionally on this program as well. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Always look forward to it.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.